Hello there, everyone. Welcome to this week's chat between myself and Ralph, who's been on holiday for the last 2 weeks in his constant search for the perfect mozzarella. Anyway, today we're going to be talking about three things, as is generally traditional. So we're going to be talking about GDP trends. We're going to be talking about the chips being down in China. And the legal firm mega merger of Allen & Overy and Shearman & Sterling. So just kicking off with regards to GDP trends, I thought it was interesting to note this week that GDP has actually, has actually come down in the, sorry, in, what am I talking about?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Replace Peter Watson with the AI avatar.
Exactly. So inflation has actually fallen down to 8.7% in April. It was 10.1% in March. Now, the thing is, it seemed that everyone had a bit of a panic attack about this. This also coincided with the Bank of England basically saying that they got their predictions wrong, and they were under a lot of pressure from, you know, lots of questioning from MPs saying why are you so useless, kind of thing. It wasn't quite like that, but it's kind of that kind of deal. Now, the thing is, everyone was sort of getting extremely worried about this. You had banks then putting up the mortgage rates, but it did make me think, why surely this is a good thing. Now, I mean, apparently the market consensus for inflation was 8.4% for April, versus the actual was 8.7. So 8.7 is obviously even with my maths is actually not as good, but you know, it's still quite a lot lower than it was in March. So I kind of wonder why this was and why everyone was getting so panicky about the whole thing, particularly as confidence, etc. And this is not just, this is consumer confidence, business confidence, all seems to be going pretty well at the moment. What's your take on that, Ralph?
Well, after 10 days in Italy, I'm now remarkably more relaxed, and what I would have to say basically is just, oh, I don't know, whatever. Let's move on to the next subject.
Okay, well, that's it then. Thank you very much.
Good. Excellent. Yeah. This one is going to be 10 minutes, I think.
Yeah, brilliant.
Joking aside, it's what we are talking about here is basically data watching. Mm-hmm. I mean, the economists have always done this. Mm-hmm. And we know this, Peter, of course, from our time in the city. There's a lot of data watching. The economists are always looking at the next inflation data, the next payroll data, jobless figures, etc. And they always have expectations of what they're going to be until the next point of announcement, and then these are going to be matched against expectations, and the city is responding in a particular way. It looks to me as if this is still going on, and what I'm about to say is a bit subtle. This is still going on, but there is no adjustment for the fact that we are now living in times with a lot more volatility and with a lot more inbuilt uncertainty about to which extent these metrics can actually be forecast at all. It's always difficult to do this. I mean, economic forecasts are notoriously hard to get right, but at a time where these metrics have shot from interest rates, for example, from 0% to soon perhaps 5% in the UK within the space of, well, two years perhaps. The transition, the volatility, the rate of change is unprecedented.
Glad you used that word. I was going to say you almost got through this without saying the word unprecedented, but
I've written it down.
Good. Yeah.
We're just waiting. Yeah. It's a long word. It makes me feel absolutely really bright and good about myself.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, but I can only say it once because it's very difficult to remember. It's got lots of syllables,
Yes.
so it's not been the case that the situation which we have now can be remembered very easily. You see, all of that is in that little word.
Unprecedented.
Let me
He
just
now
say
got to try
unprecedented.
to not saying the word unprecedented. But anyway, yeah.
Now
Well,
the
actually, what about
episode's.
the next? Let's do the other phrase, new normal. Okay,
Oh
new
God,
normal.
no, that I'm not going to say. So
Okay, good. No.
anyway, so the rate of change is a lot higher than it used to be,
Yeah.
and there is now an inbuilt uncertainty which is far higher than it is anyway embedded in this forecast. But the city, I think it sort of it seems to me as if people are not properly adjusting their expectations for that. So the Bank of England was expecting 8.4%, I believe.
Yeah.
The reality was 8.7%. That's 30 bips difference. That's not a lot measured against the volatility of these metrics. I would take away from this that inflation is coming down very materially indeed from levels above 10%, which we had just recently, and that therefore the journey is going into the right direction. And yet, the city was already pricing in some better news that we got. I would not necessarily see that as a problem, because I do not believe that 8.7% rather than 8.4 is a reversal of a downwards
No,
trend and we're going
exactly.
back up now. So it is just a little blip on the journey and this is not going to matter very much. What I find interesting there in this context, however, is that banks were putting up mortgage rates. Now, that's sort of a little bit sorry, I'm laughing about this because it's actually, well, there's nothing funny in this really for people who have to pay higher mortgages, but
No, it's not, no.
typically banks pick up their mortgage rates after the Bank of England has increased interest rates. Now inflation hasn't fallen by quite as much as people were expecting, and therefore the expectation is now swinging towards an anticipation of a further rate hike. And it looks to me as if the banks have basically now said, "Ooh, might as well increase mortgage rates now," almost like ahead of that rate hike. We've recently, in the last or so episode, talked about the fact that the terms and conditions of mortgages were being softened. The no deposit mortgage was back. And I think all of that is because banks are struggling. They need to protect revenue. They need to increase revenue by selling more mortgages. And almost in a counterintuitive way, I think they are seeing an opportunity now to do it ahead of a Bank of England interest rate increase, which now looks more likely, and that might well be the last one, and then they can basically lower mortgage rates in line with decreasing interest rates from then. I mean, that's the only thing which I can see. It is sort of economically a little bit surprising because it does buck the underlying trend.
I mean, it's a bit like, I suppose it's a bit like when you if a supermarket, let's say, puts up the price of something, of some like basic goods, and then over subsequent weeks and months makes a big go of saying, hey, look, we're cutting the prices because we are, listening to you. When in actual fact, they put the price up before anyway, very quietly. So, I mean, I wonder whether that, yeah, I again, I also wonder whether that's the case. And like I say, I did, the direction is down, right? The direction is down, so that should be a good thing. But I wonder again whether it coming at the same time as the Bank of England had to basically explain itself in front of a load of politicians, whether that kind of didn't go down too well. But the other, I mean, the other thing though, which just I thought was interesting this week from in that kind of arena is how Germany How Germany has is now in officially in recession. So you know, a recession is when you've got two consecutive quarters of economic contraction, or if you want to be, you know, cool about it, it's two consecutive quarters of negative growth.
I was waiting for that.
I know. I bloody hate that. I hate that phrase. It's contraction. It's not negative growth. It's contraction. But anyway,
I love negative growth as much as I love unprecedented.
Brilliant. So this is interesting that this is falling into recession, because it was only, I think, last week that I think it was the European Commission, or you know, they basically they increased with GDP forecasts, and I said this at the time because everyone was kind of expecting Germany to go into recession. Now they have fallen into recession. You're thinking, well, hold on a minute, how can Europe grow more than before if Germany is now officially in recession? Because Germany, it makes up 24% of Europe's GDP. So how do you work that one out? And you know, it also made me think, well, I don't think, another country must be doing exponentially better in order to, you know, increase the average. And I don't get the feeling it's France. I really wouldn't have thought it's Italy. So where is all this coming from? So I don't know. I thought that was a very strange move by Europe in the past. And last week. And I did sort of think, well, are they doing the time-honoured thing of basically trying to talk it up first before actually doing something about it?
I don't know. I have what to say reckon? I haven't followed the numbers there in detail. Sometimes, all this forecasting game is a treacherous game. I mean, sometimes you expect, in this case, Germany to fall into recession. Then Germany does fall into recession, but it's actually not as severe a recession as you would have thought. And that gives you a little bit of room to upgrade your overall growth forecast. I don't know whether that is what it was, because I haven't actually looked behind the data. It sounds odd. I agree, but I get the feeling that from economic data watching, we get a little bit of a better picture now than we did a year ago. Whatever the ins and outs are, whether inflation is 30 bips worse than expectation, or whether Europe increases the forecast, although its biggest economy is now in recession. I don't know. The underlying trend is still towards the better, I think. And just one last thought on the inflation situation in the UK. Yes, I mean, we both appear to agree that perhaps the 30 bips difference between expectation and actuality is not actually the crux so much. But there's also the relative position of the UK versus the European economies. And inflation in the UK is stuck at a higher level.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But again, that would only matter if that differential somehow worsened. It would only matter, it would only fuel pessimism or disappointment if that differential had somehow worsened, and I don't see that happening either. So it seems to be a bit of a blip. I don't really think there is much happened there, but much actual negative news came out of that.
I agree. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting, right? I mean, you know, we just saw a few, I saw a few kind of data points that I thought the reaction seems a bit strange. But anyway, obviously we'll see what happens, see how the summer goes, etc.
Well, I mean, the one last comment, of course, what is true is everybody is, it's data watching, but it's almost like nervous data watching, when everybody a lot more is riding on these metrics to really be in line with expectation, so that they actually do support an improving trend. I think everybody is now finally crisis fatigued, if that's a
Yeah,
word,
yeah.
and people want the
Hmm.
economy to get better. I mean, there are
Yeah.
certainly a lot of. I would actually not agree with people who say most of the city, most of share prices are psychology. That's not true. Most of it is fundamentals, but the psychology that goes into expectations and reality versus expectations is actually a potent factor. And I think currently this the psychology and the sensitivity of people looking at the various metrics is heightened, has just been heightened because of the unprecedented level of these metrics. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what I'm going to say, and
Good.
it gave me
Good.
another opportunity to use the word.
Excellent. Excellent. Fantastic. Good. Well, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah,
And on
pleasure.
off the back of that high, we'll move on to the next topic of conversation, where the chips are down in China, because one of the things that happens, the big thing that happens with regard to China this week, is that the Cyberspace Administration of China, or CAC, they decided to ban Micron technology, and using Micron Technologies chips in China, because they proposed serious network security risks, and so yeah, so that is serious for Micron, because about 25% of its sales come from China and Hong Kong, but it's not that big a deal really from China's point of view, because they can easily replace those chips that Micron makes with similar chips that are manufactured by Samsung and SK Hynix. Now, the interesting thing here, well, I mean, that's interesting in itself, but the plot thickens, because you have, recently we had Joe Biden seeing that this could be become the case for Micron technology, and approaching the South Korean government and saying, please make sure that your chip makers are not the ones that make up the shortfall if China decides to ban Micron. And so what the South Korean government has done in response is to say, well, not us. This is up to we're not going to say anything. We're not going to get involved. We'll let Samsung and Hynix decide. So, talk about the mother of all hospital passes. But basically, this means that Samsung and Hynix are going to have to decide who do they want to offend less, the US or China, and that is going to be very difficult, because there's so much riding on either side, because you've got, Samsung and Hynix wanting to access the massive amount of money that is available, has been made available by the US Inflation Reduction Act for production of high tech stuff in the US. So they want to access that, but equally, you've got the Chinese with saying we, you know, potentially being a massive market for them. So it's a very difficult balancing act, because who do they want more? But again, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh God, this is indeed a minefield. It seems to be business news. So you would think, oh, I can analyze this by using, by looking at business strategy, etc. But I wonder whether you can. It seems to be more politics than business, which is going on here. And I find all this very difficult to unravel. Just to take up the last comment you made, to the extent that Samsung are already manufacturing in the US, they would, I believe that is true, be a beneficiary of the support of the anti-inflation an inflationary act or whatever the thing is called, unless the US would actually restrict the benefit in some way. But they can't really do that because that would be an obvious political intervention into what the US surely will wish to safeguard, which is free market forces. And so I find it difficult for Samsung indeed to negotiate this this challenge, but in the end, I think what will prevail, certainly in the short term, and now I'm going back almost on what I said earlier, is business sense, and Samsung will, of course, and the South Korean chip makers in general will, of course, supply to China, because that is now a market where a major player has exited. And creating a vacuum and an opportunity for new entrants. Not just
it's a massive
that.
Open goal, isn't it? It's a massive open goal. It's like
not just that, but also China. Yeah. China will want to, will invite these companies to sell. But you see, in the end, the question is, what is being pursued here? What's the end game? Why did China do this? I mean, it's hard not to think now about almost everything that China does in the context of a potential presence in Taiwan. Let me call it presence rather than necessarily invasion. But of course, that is what we're all thinking about. And perhaps if I put this into that sort of hypothetical context, then what might transpire is that China is preparing a business landscape in China, which is more robust against future sanctions in response to such an invasion. Because obviously, if the US could just sanction, and it will certainly sanction chip making in China, but if it's booted out the main US chip maker already and has supplanted the loss of supply from other sources, then that particular opportunity to levy sanctions against it will perhaps be less. But of course, it's a game of chess, I mean, or a game of croquet, where we're trying to predict like 10 moves out. I mean, it's very hard to know, because obviously South Korea will also probably be within an alliance then. It just seems to be that on balance, I think China might think that it is going to be easier to do business with South Korea in such a situation than with the US. Let me put it that way.
I mean, the other thing as well is, you know, to throw into the mix, of course, is would South Korea be better, you know, advised to align itself more with China? Because, you know, China will kind of controls what happens with North Korea, you know, or it can have a very big say in what happens with North Korea. So on the one hand, it could align more, it makes sense to align more with China. But then on the other, how does it feel about the potential disruption of the region if China invades Taiwan? So if you take that into account, then you, so on the one hand, you could say that actually South Korea is potentially better, you know, placed and, you know, would be better advised to align itself more with China. But then on the other hand, it'd be better off continuing to align itself with the US and Japan, for instance.
Indeed. So, yeah, I think absolutely. And this would be, of course, the scenario which we're facing. If China were to invade Taiwan, then swiftly an alliance between, non-autocratic states, let's say, would come into existence. And this alliance would certainly involve the US, Japan, and I think also South Korea, because their position in the Southeast Asian Sea, they will need to see that protected. And so if South Korea is somehow aligned with China, it sort of there's a danger that it gets sucked into this, because and become I wouldn't quite say subservient state to China, but obviously the influence of China will then wane, and I think in the end South Korea will wish to limit that political influence. But for now, I think the move is clear. I mean, Biden can say all he wants to the government in South Korea without the presence, the clear presence of an actual political crisis. South Korea is not going to tell its chip makers not to be present in China, because in the end, if China does invade Taiwan, then you can actually join an anti-China alliance when it is necessary, and join into sanctions to be levied as and when. And there was another, I don't know exactly what it was, but there's a sort of a historical sort of antipathy, let's say, between Japan and South Korea. But recently there was a rapprochement between the two countries, and I think that is already in anticipation of what might actually happen to the balance of power in the Southeast Asian Sea were China to invade Taiwan. And at such a moment, I think sanctions would be levied, whether they are going to come from the US against China directly or from an alliance against China is probably not going to be important. So in the end, it looks to me as if China perhaps is positioning itself to saber rattle or increase its influence in Taiwan in some way or another. We will just have to see. It's maybe I'm overreacting, but from a political point of view, it's not really making me happy to see all this posturing
No.
and jockeying into positioning, which I have seen in China happening over the last several months.
Fair enough. So yeah, so it's a very tricky one. But again, I'd say to any, listeners here, I mean, it's definitely worthy of thinking about, and it is quite, I think it's a very complex situation, and so many issues and interests are very tightly intertwined, and it's difficult to see how to work that one out. So we just need to stay on the sidelines and see how it goes. But anyway, let's move on to the third and final topic of this podcast, and that is probably the biggest news, certainly in professional services last week, which was the mega merger between Allen and Overy and Shearman and Sterling. So Allen and Overy, Magic Circle, UK law firm, or a global law firm really, and Shearman and Sterling, who are based in New York. I mean, this is to create a $3.4 billion law firm, and it's the reason why I say this is because it is the biggest transatlantic merger, or first transatlantic merger since 2000. But when Clifford Chance joined, joined up with Rogers and Wells, but this is, it's interesting. So I've talked to a lot of people this week, mainly in the legal kind of area, and I just wonder, whether is this going to be the catalyst for what big, what happened with Big Bang and investment banks in the UK? Does this mean we are going to see a huge wave of transatlantic mergers? Now, I think that this week, I am sure that at least all the Magic Law Circle law firms, if not the Silver Circle law firms, will have had meetings about what do you think this means? Do we want to go down the same route? And what happens if we get a hostile approach, for instance? So, or an unforeseen approach. Now, this is going to sound brutal, right? But I know that some people have said that Shearman Sterling lawyers will get paid a lot more than Allen and Overy lawyers. So if you get the two together, what's going to happen? Are the Shearman Sterling lawyers going to suddenly get a massive pay cut, or are the Allen and Overy lawyers going to get a sudden pay increase? Now, I would have thought that one possible consequence of this merger, although the companies have been at pains to say there will be no cost cuts at this stage, I would have thought logically what they will do is they'll see where Shearman and Sterling are strong and there is overlap with Allen and Overy, they potentially could cut those Allen and Overy lawyers. Similarly, over in the UK, anywhere where Allen and Overy is superior to Shearman and Sterling, they cut those areas of Shearman and Sterling. Then that way, this sounds terrible, but they save money that they can then pay to the Allen and Overy lawyers to bump up their pay. So to try to keep them, on side. Because at the end of the day, you can't, I think that having such a massive differential between the two sides is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think could happen is any overlapping areas, you cut the areas of, the weaker partner, if you like, you cut them completely. And then you end up in theory with the best of both worlds. Now, this is assuming, of course, that lawyers don't get disillusioned by the whole thing and start leaving in their droves on either side. This is all things being equal, or cateris paribus, as they say. That's one of the only phrases I remember from doing law. I think this is very interesting, and I think that lots of lawyers will be looking at this very, very closely because they will want to know what is going on. I suspect legal headhunters have been on the phones with all these people potentially to help them jump ship. But the other thing that makes me think that there might be job losses here is that there are already job losses going on at other firms, mm-hmm. other big firms, because of the lack of M&A deal, ironically, the lack of M&A deal flow. And so therefore, that's, what's justifying this. So if my argument there is that actually, if there is a general culling, then for a merger like this particular merger, this may not be such a bad time to cull from a very top down business point of view. Obviously, from a human point of view, it's a terrible thing. But in terms of if you are looking at from a purely strategic point of view, I wonder whether that's likely to happen. But what do you reckon, Ralph? And then, by the way, both of us are looking at this from we are outsiders, right? I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I don't work for a law firm or anything like that, and neither does Ralph. But I think it's interesting to look at it from an outsider's point of view. So what do you reckon, Ralph?
Yeah, exactly. That's the caveat I would have led with. I'm not a lawyer, of course, and our listeners know a lot more about this subject but certainly me. Any kind of M&A at first always makes me wonder why it was done. Where is the business rationale? What is the strategy behind it? Why does it make sense, and why is it compelling? Part of that can only be answered by looking at the actual the consideration which has been paid, and I don't know the details of this. So I don't know whether this is an expensive deal or whether this is a reasonable deal. But the way this always works is that in a merger of this nature, Company A and Company B come together, money changes hands, and at that point, no value has been created yet. What then also happens is that there is going to be overlap of the admin functions, and there is therefore potential to diversify or to rationalize, and some people will lose their jobs. That unfortunately is the idea of a merger. Not the main idea, but it is part and parcel of the financial strategy or the financial reasoning. But unfortunately, the costs which are being saved in this way are typically priced into the consideration paid. So you get the consideration paid for what people think the business is worth, plus the present value of the cost synergies, synergies, can't really call it synergies, the cost, it's always called synergies, but what it actually is overlap. And that is being paid as a premium. So this is already in the price. And so again, no value has been created at this stage. But the rationale of a merger is, of course, to create value. So where is this value? And the value can only come from a situation that the combined entity has something that the two standalone entities do not have. And my business has been insurance for a long time. And so in insurance, this can be weird and wonderful. This can be increased diversification and capital diversification, economic capital, all very esoteric, but it sort of makes sense. In businesses where you do not have this financial engineering going on in the balance sheet and elsewhere, the value generation can really only come from revenue increase. And there you would then have to have the situation that in this case, Allen & Overy brings something to the US clients, which the US clients cannot purchase from Shearman already, and vice versa. So in search of what that might be, and forgive me, our audience, I'm not a lawyer and you probably know this better than I, but I looked up what the fields of activity of the two companies really are. And so let me just read out a little bit of this to you. I'm going to start with Shearman and Sterling. Anti-Corruption and Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Antitrust, capital markets, corporate governance, derivatives and structured products, emerging growth, environmental, executive compensation, employee benefits, finance, financial institutions advisory, and financial regulatory. The list goes on, but let's stop there.
Now that's I'm A to F to, so far.
Now I'm going to Allen & Overy. Anti-bribery and corruption, antitrust, asset management, banking and finance, commodities regulation and enforcement, corporate and M&A, derivatives and structured finance, employment and benefits, environment, financial services, regulation and investigations. And no, I was not reading out the same list. I was actually really reading out the Allen and Overy list. The areas are remarkably similar. Sometimes the words used to describe the area of activity are identical. So of course I don't know where the revenue mix is. It is entirely possible that Allen and Overy is stronger in one field than Shearman, but if you put the two together, no prizes for guessing. I don't think that the merged entity is going to be all that much different from the standalone entities in terms of their revenue mix. So again, where is the benefit going to come from? And I do wonder whether it is just sheer size which is being targeted here. So my metaphor for this is, if you're a fish trawler, if you have a bigger net, then you catch more fish. It doesn't have to be better net or a more efficient net or whatever. It's just bigger. So you catch more. And so you make more earnings, and et cetera. And that doesn't necessarily have to mean that it is more efficient, that you get a better return on equity. But what it may mean is that you just basically catch more clients, because you are going to be the one behemoth, the go-to company, the first company anybody thinks of if they have to do corporate M&A, IPO, I'll read the list out again, any legal advice in any of these areas, you go to the new company. And then, of course, there is also going to be some element, probably, of diversification, this is possibly not quite the right word, synergy in the client roster. They are going to be wealthy individuals. They're going to be companies which have locations in the UK and the US. And these companies are probably going to be a more natural client of a company which has equal strength in both of these markets than a client of two companies which are standalone in each of these markets. So that is where I see some synergies. Haven't looked at the numbers. I don't know whether the deal is expensive or not. But that is, I think, where the overall business strategy is going to be. Now, to your point specifically, yes, there is going to be a lot of overlap, as we can see. I mean, the lists are identical. So it is not just going to be admin staff which are going to be overlapped. It's also going to be, unfortunately, lawyers. And I don't know whether this dynamic is going to mean that we're going to save some money from letting lawyers down the chain go and equalizing the remuneration for the higher placed lawyers. It's hard to know. I think when I remember one of my companies I worked in, there was a different remuneration structure in the US and in the UK. Nobody really saw that so much as being disadvantaged against the US. It was just accepted as a different remuneration scheme. And let's not forget, and this is my final comment, the way in which your compensation package is being organized and structured, that also will deliver a benefit in a way that the actual numbers don't. You know, we were not talking just about basic salary. We're talking basic salary and long-term and short-term incentivization plans, etc. And so I think this is how this is going to be managed, perhaps. But unfortunately, I think with a activity list which is near identical, we're going to see a lot of overlap and commensurately a lot of cost synergies, which unfortunately means in the real world a lot of people are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, that's of course if it goes through, because
yes, of course,
as we saw recently, EY, it was all looking like, you know, they were going to separate their business. Then the two American side of the business and the UK side of the business, their respective partners did a vote, and it ended up, you know, they didn't end up splitting the business after all, having incurred huge costs. And they've just, you know, that's now died. So, you know, so this is assuming, of course, that both sets of partners agree to it. So it's not a done deal. But, you know, if it is, then it obviously increases the chances of other, you know, Me Too deals from other law firms.
And
so
I'm pretty sure that's going to happen if this goes through. But by the way, I wonder who's advising them.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Looking at the list, can't advise themselves. But anyway, if this goes through, I think it's going to, it may well set a, Oh yeah, it may well set a precedent. You see, I'm just fluent in all variations, in all morphological variations of this word.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I like it.
Actually, I'm going to stop talking, but that was just on a linguistic high.
Oh, brilliant! A linguistic high mic drop moment. Boom. Brilliant. Boom. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, all very interesting stuff. Some big stuff. Some very kind of complicated and knotty stuff that isn't easily resolved, but important nevertheless, impactful, and something that, you know, things matters that we really will be you know, looking at and revisiting again in the future.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you go, we managed to go through a whole episode without even mentioning AI. Which is pretty amazing. I mean, we could have
done. I'm not going to say it. If you don't mention it, I can't say it.
No, fair enough. Well, it's a good job I haven't mentioned it then, isn't it? Yeah.
But there's lots going on in AI. We have to talk about this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I won't. I won't. You won't get me into this.
No,
these
we'll get
subjects.
Good.
That's it.
Anyway,
I can talk about mozzarella. Do you want to hear about mozzarella?
Yeah, go on then. Yeah.
Oh, you caught me out.
No,
There's actually
right.
precious little to say what the
Oh,
subject
really?
is white, and it and the
That's
milk has to
nice.
run out when you cut into it. If it doesn't,
Nice.
it's not fresh. Let it
Yeah.
go back to the kitchen.
Basically, like a cheesy chocolate fondant, right? That's basically what it's got to
That's
do.
pretty much true,
A
yes.
cheesy chocolate
Excellent.
fondant.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that note, on that cheesy note, have a great time, enjoyable time, whatever you're doing outside listening to this podcast, and we'll be back again next week. So many
We
thanks.
will be back.
Okay, brilliant. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for
Bye.
listening, guys.